This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Despite the hopes and warnings of a generation, humanity is heading for the darker path of more fossil fuel development. Today's politicians are all about new pipelines, fracking, tankers, super coal mines, Arctic drilling, and of course, endless oil. It didn't have to be that way. We had other choices. But now the co-founder of the permaculture movement says, welcome to the brown tech future. That train to climate disaster must be derailed for us to survive, he says, in a provocative essay called Crash on Demand. When it comes to David Holmgren, you've either heard of him in an almost reverent way, or you haven't a clue. Along with Bill Mollison, David started the permaculture movement back in the 1970s. He's experimented with it ever since, from eco-villages and food forests to retrofitting suburbia. His 2002 book, Permaculture, Principles and Pathways Beyond Sustainability, is the manual. David is not a huge self-promoter. Outside of Australia, he's known mainly by people seeking alternatives to the system of endless growth and pitiless pillage of the land. David Holmgren, thank you for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
It's good to join you.
I'd like to get right to work on your essay, Crash on Demand. We'll assume that most of our EcoShock listeners know what permaculture is, although we're always learning about that. You also come from the peak oil movement. Could you explain the progression of the three essays that lead up to this present one?
Yes, well, the Future Scenarios work, which was initially put up as a website by permaculture colleague Adam Grubb, who actually started Energy Bulletin and became resilience.org, of course, in 2008. And then a couple of years later, I wrote an essay, Oil versus Money, Battle for Control of the World, which sort of really enlarged on some aspects of the Future Scenarios work. And then the Crash on Demand essay, the latest one, which there's been quite a lot of response to, was really calling the fact that of my four scenarios, the brown tech future seems the most predominant one in the world at the moment. Those original four scenarios were not what I call necessarily long-term futures for humanity. They were snapshots of that they would emerge over the next 10 to 40 years. And they, you know, might be stable for, you know, a decade or quite a few decades. But they're all characterized as being energy descent scenarios. So that future scenarios work was nested in the larger claim that I made in Permaculture Principles and Pathways, my major work on permaculture, which was published in 2002, really saying that permaculture design principles are a sensible adaptation for a world of energy descent, where there's less resources and energy for each succeeding generation on the planet. Not necessarily by some smooth, gradual process, but to distinguish it from the what I call the techno-stability scenarios of mainstream environmentalism, or the collapse scenarios, which has been used very loosely to sort of really mean the end of civilization and maybe even the end of a planet that could support human life. So I've been, I suppose, along with John Michael Greer, prominent in promoting this idea of the energy descent future. So my scenarios are nested within that, but at the extreme, the green tech future scenario and the lifeboat, they do verge on the edges of being energy descent into, at one end, techno stability, and at the other end, into what I would call genuine collapse. But this word collapse is, you know, so loosely used and in relation to all different systems that it's sometimes hard to get the nuance of where different commentators are coming from.
You seem to be saying in your new essay that we've missed the boat on green tech and earth stewardship. Do you have any idea why that is?
Well, firstly, my scenarios are not primarily driven by political or ideological or value decisions by people. They're sort of largely outcomes of what humanity's done in the form of peak oil and climate change, but they are not necessarily, they're not scenarios that we choose. So the green tech scenario inherently was one of slow decline post-peak in oil supply and one of relatively benign or slow onset of climate change that allowed a lot of time for both mitigation and adaptation. Now, it's really on the climate change that we seem to have missed the boat in that regard. And you could say it's because we didn't sort of do anything substantial since Kyoto in 97, the Kyoto Protocol, or going back further, that we didn't really start to restructure the world radically as a result of the evidence of the Limits to Growth Report in 1972. But another part of that is that the science on climate change has actually not been very good, at least in the mainstream IPCC stuff, at predicting how severe and intense the erratic weather footnote of climate change predictions going back 20 years. There was always this footnote, increase in extreme weather events. And those increases in extremes are what human systems, like natural systems, are most vulnerable to. The focus on average global temperatures is a classic sort of scientific measuring baseline, but it doesn't tell us much about what we are likely to face. So I think most people in the climate area, while focusing intensely on the doubt raised about the science by denialists, seem less willing to acknowledge that actually it looks worse than what the predictions have been. So that just naturally puts us into the brown tech world, where you have this combination of relatively rapid onset of climate change and the relatively slow decline in oil. And that sets up some conditions that then human systems, everything from corporations, nation states, global governance structures, right down to households and individuals, are forced to respond. And that's what, you know, creates that brown tech world. And in the future scenarios work, I suggested that two more severe scenarios of Earth Steward and Lifeboat, it was very hard to see how they could emerge directly from the globalist industrial world that we've been living in. That the effectively to go from where we've been to there would be experienced as catastrophic collapse of civilization. Even if in the longer term they weren't, but they would be very severe. What I suggested, a more likely pathway, was where green tech would segue down into Earth Steward and brown tech might drop more precipitously into Lifeboat. So the nuance in those scenarios is quite complex, and I think inevitably some of the discussion that's happened about my latest essay has been in a context where people get part of what I'm on about with these four scenarios, but in other ways they don't necessarily, you know, have seen the subtlety or the nuances or the factors in them that are independent of human choice.
And you've taken another step. I mean, I'm seeing the whole world really going for fracking. It's happening in Canada and Britain and, of course, America. Everybody's counting on it to save national governments from immense debts. They're counting on it. Will it work? And also, I want to point out that Australia is committing to far more coal production. So, David Holmgren, can this fossil-powered engine of self-destruction be stopped? And what is your suggestion on how it could be stopped?
Well, firstly, those are some of the strongest signs that we are in the brown tech world, where the responses to economic contraction, high energy costs, and unstable climate all involve very large resource extraction projects and infrastructure development projects, which all collectively further accelerate greenhouse gas emissions. So ironically, in this brown tech world, there's not actually much concern about climate change at the top level. In fact, it all ends up accelerating it further. But the fact that the money flow has continued in spite of the shock to the system in 2007, 2008, the flow of capital from the banking system into the resource extraction industries, the coal industry, the oil industry, has accelerated. And that has meant they've just managed to keep the supply end up in combination with the contraction in demand, which has happened because of economic contraction. So that is, again, the classic extended slow decline in energy production. Of course, underpinning that is a much stronger reduction in net energy production. But all of these responses are completely destructive to humanity's long-term future, let alone that of any other life forms on the planet. I believe the only thing that will stop that is a failure in the flow of capital, because none of these things can happen without the signal that capital provides. And once capital flows stall, then all of the other logistical systems that are necessary to even deliver any of these resources or maintain existing systems are vulnerable to actually stalling. Even though we could say, oh, well, there's actually plenty of resources for the time being, sustain basic human systems. But it doesn't necessarily mean that will occur because of this interlocking we now have with the financial system and with very complex just-in-time logistics and all of the other novel features of the global economy. So the stopping of that financial system, of course, is just a human construct that depends ultimately on faith. To some extent, faith of the billion or so middle-class people who have some savings and some asset around the world, and then faith of a smaller set of money market managers, which really represent, you know, relatively small numbers of people, and the people they serve, you know, the genuine global elite, if you like, the 1% or less. So that faith is something that can be turn on and turn off according to factors that are completely in the psychosocial domain. Therefore, they are amenable to influence by factors within that psychosocial domain. So this is this enormous vulnerability, but I don't believe, you know, there's a sort of a policy mechanism by which nation states will say, oh no, you know, Australia will just leave the coal in the ground. We'll choose to do these things. I think that, yeah, that seems that there's so much evidence now that that's not going to happen. And all of the effort to sort of try and get mass political movements to make that happen are sort of predicated on a notion of, oh, well, once you get a majority of people, or at least a majority of people in affluent countries, to agree, then this will somehow happen. But we have plenty of evidence from recent history that that's not the case. Getting a simple majority on something is not necessarily what's necessary to change a system by deliberate intent.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith talking with David Holmgren. And David, I've had scientists on the program who agree that only a devastating crash of the current economy can reduce greenhouse gases fast enough to make the difference that we need, but it's not a popular idea. How has your essay, Crash on Demand, been received?
Well, I think within the circle of people who pay attention to these issues, it's ranged from, yes, that's self-evident and obvious and has been for a long time, through to great dismay and perhaps even a sense of betrayal by people who are working very hard at trying to get the small-scale initiatives like transition to scale up into mass popular process but perhaps more importantly, get support at the policy and political level for those initiatives. Because clearly, if you're trying to argue to politicians and policymakers that this change to relocalisation of economies, to frugal living away from consumerism, to reducing debt, all of these sorts of things that are actually the obvious sensible strategies for people to pursue, that this is actually a mortal threat to the growth economy. And, you know, there's many people, of course, at various levels saying, oh, no, it's not. In the same way that a lot of people who've promoted the very rapid transition to renewable energy, saying all this can be done without actually really adversely affecting a growing economy. Somehow the economy can grow without growth in energy and resource use, or that can be done in ways that somehow are completely carbon neutral. So there's already a huge scepticism in established and conservative circles whether it is possible to make any of these changes without risking crashing the economy, or at least crashing the financial system. And of course, as I said before, because the financial system now has grown so large and complex and is such an overriding governance structure on the underlying material economy, those two things are increasingly seen as probably the same thing. A crash of the financial system would create a crash of the material economy. So, yeah, the reactions at that level, have been quite varied. There's also been the warnings, of course, that by saying this, you are inviting blame for it when it happens, and this scapegoating process, which, of course, I addressed that in my essay as well, because I've been well aware that as things unravel, it's quite natural for marginal groups, and including people who've been warning of the crisis, getting the blame for it. And that's why I was sort of very careful overall in the essay to, show the conclusions. But, I think the reaction's been very, very good and very interesting, and it's brought out various other nuanced positions. There's been some aspects of what I'd intended that haven't been discussed so much, but maybe those discussions will still emerge.
It's been a long haul for you, David Holmgren, 38 years of pursuing permaculture, and I'm wondering now at this time in its life, if it isn't really more in the lifeboat position, the people who are doing it are thinking to themselves, well, if this does fall over, or even if it doesn't, this is a better way to live. But what's your reaction to that?
Well, there's always been these aspects of permaculture. Back in the 70s, many of us thought that as soon as the market understood the effect of depleting resources, that it would price in higher prices, and this would lead to rapid social and economic transition back in the 80s. We thought this would happen. There were also, fairly naive versions of people's notions of lifeboat survival. These were part of the discussions that were going on in the 70s. They then became very unfashionable in the 80s, and they've, come back quite strongly. Now, of course, that's used as some of the evidence that, we've heard all this sort of doom and gloom before. And the whole issue of people's motivation for permaculture, from personal lifestyle choice to symbolic rejection of the values of society, through to providing models for which benign social evolution might occur in the future, through to lifeboat survival, have all been motivators for different people at different points of their journey with permaculture. So I see it's a very complex, multi-layered set of motivations, but part of me sees the question of whether permaculture is a political strategy. It hasn't been seen as such, and I think that's been part of its strength. But it's also led to people who work at the big end trying to change policy, trying to change the wider society. I've often just sort of seen permaculture is over there as a little lifestyle thing. Yes, it's symbolically trying to change things, but it doesn't really deal with any of the hard issues at the scale that's necessary. And then the step beyond that is to regard it as a selfish thing, that it's, yes, like looking at creating your own lifeboat while the rest of the world sinks. But I think those sort of perspectives have, over decades, have missed the point that the success of permaculture is because there is a core of self-interest. But this is a better way to live for people right now, for those who have the energy and the motivation to, if you like, swim against the tide and create their own world. So permaculture from the beginning was really informed by that we want to create the world we do want rather than fight against the world we don't want. But in creating that world, it's not through atonement for our past sins. It's because we're going to get something beneficial from this. And immediately you articulate that motivation or that evidence, a lot of the political activists immediately see that, oh, well, that's just self-interest. And therefore, it's not actually of any validity or use in bringing about wider societal change. But I've argued that you must start with a framework where the early adopters, the people who make the most difficult change against the psychosocial norms, actually get a benefit from it. Because that's the positive feedback loop, you know, that we say in the permaculture principle, obtain a yield. You've got to get some benefit from what you do. It's the same basic logic that people understand in small business or people who are farmers. You know, there's got to be an immediate return to say, well, let's do it again. That worked. And then when you have that developed at the sort of household and small scale, then the other people can copy that because it's at the same operational scale to them. And they don't require approval by government or financing by banks because it's something they can actually do themselves. And that small-scale replication, if that takes off to any degree, that creates a cohort of people who then have some sort of political bargaining power and also can be a model for larger-scale change. Whereas when you try and change things from the top in a radical way, I think there's evidence from the history of social revolutions and the evidence from system theory that it doesn't work. It all goes awry. And so you have to start with simple systems that work and scale up. So whether you're talking about a personal lifeboat, a model for viral replication, which will change the world in a positive way, or viral replication, which will pull a destructive system down, or replication which reaches a scale that allows political negotiation with powers that be, any way you look at it, these same strategies work. So it's not about, and this is the key thing, it's not necessarily about saying, oh, we're moving into a lifeboat world or we're in the brown tech world. You've got to have strategies where you can adapt and work within all those scenarios. And I think there's a lot of people who sort of recognise that, you know, permaculture and related strategies. In saying permaculture, I'm not doing that in an exclusive way to, deny a whole lot of related activism and activity that, might not have the label permaculture on it. But this bottom-up, do it yourself, do it for your own good, do it for the good of the wider community and the wider planet, that those types of strategies do have potential power, and that it's a message that I'm trying to get those who've poured their life's energy into trying to get political change might see that what we're doing over this side of the fence might be worth contributing to, given how dismal mainstream political change really looks now.
Well, as we wrap up for now, how would you advise listeners to find your work? Could you give us your website and maybe one or two books that they could be reading?
Yeah, the website's holmgren.com.au, and there's quite a lot of my work available on that. There's also the Future Scenarios book, And of course, my major work, Principles and Pathways Beyond Sustainability, is really the thinking tools behind the whole permaculture movement that people are saying can be applied in any context, anywhere, whether you have land or not. And that's now available in quite a few different languages, and there's further translation work happening on that.
From Australia, we've been talking with the co-founder of permaculture, David Holmgren, designed and guided new villages, and he's inspired thousands of perennial food forests around the world. You can look up David and Crash on Demand to find the work we've been talking about, or you can find links in my show blog at ecoshock.info. And David, I have to say, that was some powerful stuff you just delivered. I'm going to spend a couple of times, maybe listen to it twice, to really parse out what you just said. Thank you so much for reaching out to our listeners.
Thank you, and thank you for your work.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.